Good morning, I'm David Ellis. Welcome to this edition of Down to Brass Tacks. I do apologize for the late start to the program. We're going until 1 o'clock. And I was going to say as usual, but you know, we are coming to that stage where we will soon be going back to 2 o'clock after the climax to crop over. 4341790, that's the number for you to call. I want to hook up with somebody from London in a short while. But in the meantime, one of the things that has really caught my attention is this electronic survey which has been sent out by the government of Barbados, in which they've been asking Barbadians to identify what they see as essential services, the highly desirable, the optional, and the optional and better delivered elsewhere. I've had a look through them. There were about 93 different government departments and statutory corporations. And the stark point coming through from all of them is that when you look at the money allocated to these agencies and these departments, about half of that allocation is going to pay wages and salaries and to look after pensions. You have some, though, that are really in trouble. Let's take the Caribbean Broadcasting Corporation. It says here that the Caribbean Broadcasting Corporation provides radio and television broadcasting services that are intended to operate as an independent, credible media house. Now, in recent times, I don't think that anybody could say that that's the way that it came across, but that's a story for another day. This entity has outstanding long-term debt of approximately $24.5 million, pension liabilities of $15.2 million, and note this, accumulated arrears of $64.6 million. So that is outstanding long-term debt of $24.5 million, pension liabilities of $15.2 million, and accumulated arrears of the magnitude of $64.6 million. Here is one that I found rather interesting. The telecommunications unit is responsible for facilitating a competitive, liberalized telecommunications sector while achieving government's vision of making Barbados a center for telecommunications in the Caribbean. Now, it is quite possible that this unit has been doing stuff behind the scenes that we knew nothing about. But from where we sit, we have seen no activity at all that suggests that this is the way that this unit has been working. Anyhow, in the financial year 2018-19, a total of $2.77 million was approved by the Parliament of Barbados for this entity. $2.77, of which $1.19 million will go towards wages and NIS. And they're asking for your opinion as to whether this state-owned entity or agency our program is essential, highly desirable, optional, and better delivered elsewhere. The Urban Development Commission. Parliament approved $6.5 million for this entity, of which $3.23 million will go towards wages and NIS, and another $181,000 towards pensions. There's the Office of Ombudsman. the National Initiative for Service Excellence. And I think you need to hear about an agency like the National Housing Corporation. Well, West Indies Shipping Corporation is another one. They allocated, it was no millions for this, it was only $71,000. But this was established in 1975, and somebody should really tell us what WISCO has been doing over the years to such a degree that the government has had to put money behind it. So I think many people have been able to see with their own two eyes the kind of money that has been allocated to a number of these agencies or programs or government departments. And what is the real dilemma that some of them face? You have to look at, I'm looking here for the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, because I thought that what they said there about that one was particularly important. But I'll share that with you a little later. The Transport Board, a number of them I will share with you. Ones that really stood out in my mind in terms of not only what has been allocated, but how much more money is needed now, and then how much debt they find themselves in. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Do we have a caller?
Hello, good morning, David.
Yes, morning.
There are a few things I want to talk about, but the Prime Minister is living up to her promises, but if it was in her position, what I would have done is to ask the populace to give me the first 5 years to clean up the mess. I think that's what should have been done.
What does that mean? The first 5 years to clean up the mess. Cleaning it up, how? Isn't that being done now?
I'm talking about giving people salary increases and all that. We are in deep trouble. I don't think the populace would have come down on her for doing that or saying that. And I mean, despite the hardship, she's trying to fulfill her promises, but that's what I would have done. How many government ministers do we have in Barbados that head government offices? Because I can't believe that I am reading what I have read this morning paper and delay work. I would like to know if they're clones of those people. I mean, for him to come and talk about the South Coast and the sewage thing, the garbage trap, was he part of the last government? If I was a newspaper publisher and didn't care how much money he was paying me, I won't publish nothing like to an MCA. I don't think that there should be allowed to speak. They were there. They did nothing. Trouble in this port, yes, he criticized. By the end of the day, when voting time came, he didn't separate himself from his colleagues. He voted with them. If that isn't being a hypocrite, tell me what it is. And I will wish.
Well, be careful. You know, that's a word that people don't really like to use. I mean,
a hypocrite is someone who says something, do something different.
Okay.
Who do the opposite to what they say.
But the truth of the matter is that it is a word that we tend to avoid when you're describing somebody. And if you're going to say that, you will then have to lay the foundation. You lay your foundation by saying that in your judgment, it is hypocritical to have served in a government and voted one way, said one thing and voted another, and now come to criticize aspects of what have been said. But we try to be very careful in the use of that kind of language.
Not that I feel. I know this government so far have done much more than they did.
But how much more? I mean, let's be truthful. Yes, I'm asking you that. How much more? Because you know, it is still very early in this government's term, and it would be difficult for them to do as much as some people seem to expect in such a short space of time. Let's accept, for instance, that the garbage situation has not been sorted out very as yet, because we don't have the additional trucks. Let's accept that we have no permanent solution yet to the sewage situation. I would say to you that part of what was done, one part of the reason why we have not had all the sewage out there, is partly because of the injection wells which were developed by the former administration. So I don't think that this government can take all the credit right now for the ease in the situation. However, what they can take credit for is apparently moving decisively to find a longer-term solution. But I think we found ourselves with the injection wells being dug before the government changed. So it's not all about this administration at all in that regard.
Haven't dug the injection wells and not utilizing them is something else.
Well, it's about timing. Bottom line is that the temporary fix that we have had has been caused by a combination of the two. You will have to credit this administration, though, for moving decisively in dealing with the problem at the Bridgetown sewage project, where the conditions were particularly bad and potentially dangerous.
Right. And while, they did that in a hurry. The next thing, too, I want to talk about.
I got somebody on the line here from London that I need to get to, so... Yeah, I think you should get to that as quickly as you can.
Okay. I hope that none of those former cabinet ministers, none, will ever seek to hold high office in Barbados ever again.
It's still
and
early.
And they can only blame themselves for that. And we keep on saying it.
It's still
last
early.
David,
It's still early, you know. We are... still fresh from the last elections.
Yeah, but David,
a lot depends upon how the current government handles the situation facing the country. You know that.
Yeah, but David, you got to remember something. This country have never been faced with the amount of taxes that we were ever faced with than with the former government. So my question is, we haven't seen any garbage trucks. We haven't seen no buses. We haven't seen a lot of things. Where did the money go, David? You want to put back that same kind of people back in office?
I'm not here talking about putting back anybody. I'm here saying to you that part of the reason why you have not seen the money is locked into the figures that I have been giving you about the amount of money that the government has been spending in wages across various government departments and statutory corporations. That is why you cannot see the money. You can't have it both ways.
Oh, and...
Okay.
We can talk about that, but my final thing here quickly, on Bright Hill, is badly in need of sidewalk on that road. It's a very dangerous road to walk.
Okay.
Talk about that some other time, though.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks.
One of the stories that has really disappointed a lot of people is the fact that the Anglican Church in Barbados has been unable to choose a new leader, and that we have reached the stage now where this matter has been referred to the House of Bishops for somebody to be chosen, with every likelihood that it may be a non-Barbadian. Now, one of the people who has been vocal on this matter is Reverend Guy Hewitt. Reverend Hewitt, the outgoing High Commissioner to London, is on the line with us from London. And we need to get your point of view on what has happened here. Two sides, Reverend Hewitt, very entrenched and difficult to move. And having had that kind of situation where nobody wanted to budge, there could be no compromise. I think that the Anglican Church looks not just like a church divided, but a church that doesn't practice what it preaches, which is compromise.
Good afternoon, David, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to interact. I would say to you this. I think the Anglican Church, the Diocese of Barbados, has found itself in a difficult situation where there has been two very strong candidates who are supported by the two different houses. Dean Gibson, who has got the support of the clergy, or I would say the larger, and Reverend Rogers, who has the two-thirds majority from the House of Laity. But I wanted to make this point, that this is not the first time that we have been here. Many people would be aware, Drexel Gomez became the Bishop of Barbados and went on to become the Archbishop of the West Indies, largely because we had this problem before. And it is one that I know some people lament, especially as we approach the 200th anniversary of the diocese. But one of the challenges we have in small jurisdictions, whether they are religious, political, social, economic, is that we sometimes don't have the space to maneuver when we find ourselves in a difficult situation.
The question is, how can we reform the process here to avoid this again in the future?
Well, I think that is one of a great question. The challenge is that the options available to the diocese in terms of selection are limited. It has basically come down to one candidate or another. There are processes that are spoken to about, like a select committee of persons who might be able to rigorously consider the two candidates and make a recommendation, but there is no process defined for that.
How do others do it?
Pardon?
How do other dioceses in the Anglican community go about this process? Is it similar?
Yes, it is. It is similar. It is similar. Sorry, go ahead.
With absolutely no variations across the world.
There are different rules in different dioceses, and I think what you are speaking to is a lesson that will be learned from this experience, that we need to now define what are the options. For instance, what we don't have in the diocese is the facility, if we wanted to go about appointing a suffragan or a few bishop or a local bishop, so that if we had two candidates who for different reasons were deemed to be strong, that we could say, well, we can have a diocesan bishop, we could have a local bishop, or if we had to, we could have one person appointed for a certain period of time and another person potentially to succeed them. In all organizations and institutions, there is a need to have that kind of flexibility. The challenge has been with the Anglican Church, as I see it, is because it has been the established church, its traditions are so long, it makes change harder. But there is, as you are pointing to, a need to look urgently for options that can ensure that a local diocese, that the Diocese of Barbados, can identify the candidate the chief pastor to lead us going forward.
Reverend Guy Hewitt, how do you see all of this hurting the Anglican Church, if at all, in Barbados?
Well, I had the privilege of going to Lambeth Palace recently, and I saw the Archbishop of Canterbury, and one of his senior advisors and assistants, and I raised the point of a need across the Anglican Communion, especially where there are small dioceses, to provide some kind of mechanism for capacity building, for conflict resolution. And this is not a conflict between candidates or conflict within the diocese. It is about the challenge of sometimes baggage or issues from the past not being resolved, and they manifesting themselves.
So what are those issues from the past that you see impacting on us now?
Because I am now, have been in London for the last 4 years, I would not want to be the one to speak with authority on that. I think that is something that I would have to defer, especially to the leadership of the diocese. But I think one of the matters are, as you're speaking to, is to make sure that at the end of every, or for every election, or beyond every election, there is the ability for the healing and to bringing a diocese together. And that, in this case, regardless of the outcome, whomever gets is appointed as the next bishop, they need to have not just the understanding, but the tools to bring about healing within the diocese. Because there are going to be on either side persons who are going to feel that the decision was not the right one. And as you said at the beginning, we are ultimately a Christian community, a community of faith, and we should be guided by love. And that should be at the forefront of whomever takes over as the next Bishop of Barbados, to see how they can bring about that healing. And as you were suggesting, reassure the nation that the church very much practices what it preaches.
What is your sense of what the Anglican Church appears to be looking for in a new leader?
Well, you see, this is part, I think, of the challenge that we face at present. The laity are looking ultimately for somebody that can inspire, somebody who has charisma, somebody who has the means of mobilizing, especially young people, those who are falling away from going to church, and to bring them back in. And that seems to be where they are drawn towards Reverend Rogers, because they see those strengths in him. With Dean Gibson, the laity or the clergy are looking at somebody who has experience in the diocese, whom they feel has served, in some estimation, serves with distinction, somebody who could lead them for a period of time, but the clergy feel is a reasonable period of time, and that would allow others to potentially aspire to a position of leadership.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time out.
I want to thank you, David, and I look forward to being back in Barbados in the near future.
Well, you're about to the Met Office too as High Commissioner, and I think it would be useful at some point to get you to share your views on Barbados's presence, especially in England, as High Commissioner to London, and some general issues related to...
I would be honored to do that. I really would. We've done great work in London, and I look forward to sharing that with you and the listeners to Starcom and the nation at some point.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All the very best.
Reverend Guy Hewitt speaking with us from London. This is Down to Brass Tacks. This person asked whether it is possible to take legal action in circumstances where somebody is at a public function. That person declines to be photographed by a reporter, but their name can still be mentioned. And I don't see that there's anything illegal about it, that you would want to lock up a journalist or somebody for that. I mean, that's really trivial. The critical issue here is that the person was not photographed, but you could say that a person, it is akin to asking a person for a comment and the person declines to comment. Should you be locked up for saying that the person declined to comment? You're really stretching it if you go in that direction. You're really not on. Down to Brass Tacks. We have some callers there. Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Harris.
Yes, good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm well, and you?
I'm remarkable, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
You just touched on an aspect of journalism and photography, et cetera. And it hinges with my first comment. I've spoken to one of your moderators this week relative to this. journalism. And you remember in the last election, I asked not to have persons in the journalistic fraternity to pronounce or announce beforehand, and then you've got to come back and apologize, etc. And we still had that glaring situation of, in the Orange Hill situation, there wasn't any vote for a candidate, etc. And then they had to come back and retract that. That wasn't really accurate. Remember, we discussed that about the reporting and not reporting beforehand or confirming, etc. You remember yourself when they had that?
Yes.
Right. So, and then I went on to ask that moderator if there was still a journalistic fraternity. And then the comment was made that because of the new media, Facebook up and all this.
Pretty social media and all of that.
And all this, that they will tend to dominate. But all I'm saying is then journalists have got to fight back and take what is right for these.
Journalism is under serious attack, huh?
It is
under attack in various ways because of the changing technology, market changes and all of that. But then add Donald Trump to it as well, huh? Do not believe for 1 minute that the kind of fight that Trump is taking to the media in the United States does not have the potential to cascade to journalism elsewhere. This notion that as long as you do not say what he wants you to say with the frequency that he wants it said makes you public enemy number one, to the point where he can incite people against the media. Donald Trump behaves in a very similar manner to the way that we have seen politicians in the Caribbean behave towards the press. That if you don't say what they want to say, then they and their cronies will be on your case on the grounds that all you report is what is negative. You never say any good news about them, notwithstanding the fact that they themselves create the opportunities for all this bad news. And it is exactly out of the playbook of politicians right here in the region.
It's unfortunate when this happens, is he? It's very unfortunate.
Well, but he's got a base. It's just like right. They have a base too. And it is the people in the base who are always on the attack. I mean, I've been through scenarios where you go to cover annual conference of these political parties and the yard fowls are the ones attacking you because they have been incited by the leadership who tell them, well, you know, this person or this particular media house is hostile to us and that sort of thing. It's the same kind of behavior. But you've never seen it in that way coming from a president of the United States. It is something to watch.
But I would say I don't subscribe to that kind of behavior as quote from you, yard foes. I don't subscribe to that period because I like decorum and good decency, etc. But let me hear something to say. Question to you then, what is going to be the future of journalism as it ought to be in the world and in our local society, etc.? What is going to be the future of journalism if you're saying it has to compete against such an entity as the social media? What is the future of it?
It's a very interesting question. It is something that people in the industry are currently analyzing. Because one of the realities is that any person with a phone these days can go there in the community and take pictures and that sort of thing. The difference ought to be that an established media house would have had a reputation for checking information and for bringing accurate stuff to you. So that's the importance of the filter at the moment. But I'll say this. It is possible for individuals outside of established media houses to rapidly develop a reputation for bringing information that is accurate and fast. All they have to do is to be committed to the effort.
Okay.
So to that extent, I believe that all the established media houses are under a greater degree of threat than they sometimes realize. All that is required is for that individual to invest the time and energy to make sure that they get it right.
So what you're saying then, journalism has evolved.
Yeah, and is evolving. I mean, you, if you look at people telling stories, just a few days ago, we were sitting down and there was a lot of rain in Grenada.
Right.
People were sending information, sending video of what was happening and telling you what was happening. They were not trained journalists.
Okay.
But they were functioning in a manner which is not that dissimilar to what is expected of trained journalists. And the truth is that some of them can do a better job of that kind of ad lib than some of the very people who have been trained journalists.
But the risk that you're taking during that is some inaccuracy can come out at interim points too.
Well, that is where I said to you a person would have to invest some time and energy in trying to improve in that regard. Yeah. So it is changing the landscape of what we know as journalism or what we have known as journalism over the years. Indeed, if you look at what is being produced these days at various levels, whether it is in print, on radio or television, you will see that there has been a change. There are people who have been in the media for a long time who will tell you, well, you know, I don't find it attractive anymore because it is not giving them what they want, what they have become accustomed to. Of course, the younger people who've come on the scene, and they tend to like the way that it is done these days.
Right.
Not as much detail, you know, but you get to the meat of the matter and move on, you know?
Yeah, I got you. You've given good account to yourself in this regard. And I must say thank you. But I'll go on to my second point quickly. Mr. Johnson and myself had a discussion recently, and the police has put out reports, and we're getting these reports every minute, as recent as last night, these head-on crashes. And then we looked at these bright lights and a myriad of other things. This is now becoming the not necessarily norm, but it's becoming a problem every minute. We hear these head-on crashes, head-on. What was Mark responsible for such a situation to be developing like this?
Well, my hunch is that... excuse me, I've got
You got a little problem niggling in your throat or something. Hello?